The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are about to have a conversation with Don Barlett and James Steele, who are award-winning investigative reporters. They've been together for over 40 years working, first at the Philadelphia Inquirer, Time Magazine, now at Vanity Fair, where they're contributing editors. The book they wrote that came out in 91, America, What Went Wrong, was a bestseller in the New York Times, but more importantly, it opened a vista of discussion that America needs to have. They've shared two Pulitzer Prizes, two National Magazine Awards. Their new book, which really is one that everybody should be thinking and talking about, is The Betrayal of the American Dream. And I want to welcome them both. Don and James, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
Good to be there.
So let me just begin. Let's take a step backwards for our listeners, if we could. And Don, maybe you could just start off by just with the book you wrote, What Went Wrong, which is in 1991, when there was still so much hope and we were in a coming out of this recession that we had. And you began to write this book about the beginnings of this attack on the middle class, as you revealed in that book. So talk a bit about what happened, how this began for you in 1991 with America, What Went Wrong.
Basically, Mark, it started out almost as a plant closing story. Jim and I went around to different cities looking at companies that had gone out of business, shipped their jobs overseas, whatever, collapsed. At any rate, the jobs were gone, or through mergers and acquisitions, jobs disappeared. And what we came back with after doing the interviews was, Jim would go to one section of the country, I go to another, and the interviews with people in totally different industries read identically. And so it told us that there was something going on in the country that nobody was seeing. And, we spent a couple of years in that project. And by the time we were finished, what was going on was very clear. The middle class was going in the early stages of disappearing. And Americans do not do very well when it comes to setting aside money for retirement. It's looked at as being too far in the future, and we'll start doing that next year. And now, of course, Congress is looking at scaling back Social Security. So this country is going to be in deep, deep, deep trouble in a decade or two.
And that's just the beginning, and I'm going to get to the heart of what you wrote about. You write about retirement in this book as well. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just start there for just a minute before we jump into the larger issues you talked about in the book. Because we've been discussing this a bit here, this whole question of benefits and retirement and how it's now kind of leapfrogging from the private sector, where you saw a lot of steel workers and others losing their benefits, losing their health benefits, left with nothing. And then after the Chicago teacher strike was settled, the headlines were all about and have been about for a while how state and city pensions and health care benefits for their retirees and their employees are in great jeopardy because they can't figure out how to pay for them. And they're not figuring out how to pay for them. And this could be the next great leap into no pensions. And so can you both give us, some of you, James, an underpinning why this is happening? I mean, because it's now leapfrogged into the public sector.
One of the most astonishing numbers we came about in this new book absolutely stunned us. Because, I mean, here at Don, I mean, we've talked about these issues, we've written about these issues for years. It's not as though we're not familiar with these things. But even we were stunned in the private sector. Since 1985, 85,000 of these private pension plans had been eliminated.
Wow.
And in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, more and more people were enrolled in those private plans. And that alone just kind of symbolizes, it's just so emblematic of what's been happening in the middle class. For years, people steadily, things getting better and more secure, and then suddenly the rug starts being pulled out from underneath them. But this has happened in the private sector. Now you can see the same kind of effort is being aimed at the public sector. Everybody has seen an example here or there where some of these public pensions are out of whack or people get to retire maybe earlier than they should. But the norm of the situation is we shouldn't be attacking the public sector right now. We should be trying to figure out ways to make sure the private sector has some security down the road. But most of the folks who, and some of the think tanks around this country who want to talk about how the deficit's out of control, how we've got to cut back, the whole emphasis when it comes to the American middle class is to take away benefits, whoever happens to have them. And that's what's been going on for years, and that's why this is a logical extension to go into the public sector now, just as it's been so effective in taking things away in the private sector.
This, Mark, this was the other thing we warned about and what went wrong. We said that the stage is being set for a war between people who work in the private sector and people who work in the public sector. The private sector having lost their pensions, the public sector having very good pensions, and that's not going to last. There's going to be, and you saw this in the Chicago strike, there is going to be a real war. I mean, why should I, and I'm one of the last of the steelworkers out there working, I don't get a pension, but I've got to, and my wages have been cut, but I've got to pay into the pension system of the school teachers. That is not going to fly. I mean, in the end, it's going to be a very, very bitter, divisive issue among the, in the population.
I know at the end of this, your new book, The Trail, you have some interesting ideas about what to do about what we're going to talk about this hour, but... I mean, we know that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal really, in many ways, saved capitalism from itself.
Exactly.
And so people are beginning to ask the question, have we reached a stage, since it's no longer just the United States of America and Western Europe that kind of has the capitalist structure of the planet, that they're in their hands, that is kind of diffused but also interlocking at the same time, that we've been using up the Earth's resources so quickly, is our system still capable of answering the question of maintaining the benefits and pensions of the social underpinnings of society that have happened between the 30s and the 70s?
Well, if the society decides it wants to do that, it can do it. I mean, what the problem has been is that so many of the folks who are forming policy, from various think tanks to certain economists to the politicians to the moneyed interests of the economic elite, and we write about this in the book, They've been shaping policy. I mean, so much of the explanation that you see about what's happening to average people in this country, they say, well, my gosh, it's the global economy. We're part of this bigger world now, and all wages are going to be driven down here. All benefits are going to be changed. Yes, we're part of the global economy. But we reject the notion, the statement, that we are powerless to do anything about that. And all you have to do is look at what's happened over time. Look at taxes. In the 1950s, the richest Americans paid 51% of their income in federal taxes. By 2007, that's down to 16%. That didn't happen by accident. That didn't happen because of the global economy. That happened because Congress lowered their taxes and plugged in various other benefits that let them pay less. The same thing is true in trade. We have a whole section on global trade. We have higher trade deficits than any developed country in the world because of the policies that we had followed on trade, not only legislatively but administratively. We've opened our doors to every product in the world, begged other countries to take our products, and when they didn't, we didn't do anything about it. So we're not powerless to control a lot of these things. It doesn't mean you retreat from the global economy. It just means you need to do some things to protect your own population. And that's what we haven't been doing for millions and millions of working Americans for decades now.
People need to stencil what Jim just said on their foreheads. There is nothing engraved in stone about this. It can be turned around, but pretty quickly, by just making a few changes. But for whatever reason, Washington has ceded control of government to a financial aristocracy that has no interest in the middle class. Their interest is in increasing and preserving global wealth, period. They see nothing else. That's all they see.
In your second chapter, The Cost of Free Trade, this is really very important. Let's just start with the notion of free trade, how it was defined in the 18th century, but what it means today. I mean, this is, because we always hear this, free trade is good for America, it's the only way we can make it, why we have to have NAFTA, but we really don't understand what the notion of free trade means in this 21st century context.
A very good question, Hank.
Exactly.
And we're not opposed to free trade. In fact, we make this point in the book that the idea of free trade is a very good idea and a very decent idea. And if it's practiced properly, it does hold out the potential of a lot of benefits. But the way we practice it in this country is totally different than really most of our trading partners practice it. The main thing about it, the original idea of free trade was that if one country can do something better than another country, wouldn't it be smart to purchase their products and then you try to specialize in your stuff and they'll buy from you and all of that evens out and is equal. But what several things were not foreseen in the old traditional view of free trade. For one, this free flow of capital around the world was totally not envisioned by Adam Smith and Ricardo back in the 18th and early 19th century. So that doesn't fit into the classic notion of free trade. The other thing is, which people who are always clapping themselves on the back about how wonderful Adam Smith was, they totally misread him on a couple of points. One is he was extremely cynical about corporations. He did not think corporations necessarily had everybody's best interest at heart, but he thought they would be kept in check by competition with each other, that alone would be the regulator. He did not foresee the growth of these kinds of huge multinational corporations that have very little global competition with each other. So that's one thing. But when it comes to the United States, the basic problem is we have opened our doors for decades to products from abroad and have not insisted on a really strong basis that other countries do the same for our products. That's one of the main problems out there, and this has been going on for years and years. Any year you can pick up the U.S. Trade Representative's office, I don't care who's in office, a Democrat or Republican, read this book. It's hundreds of pages long. It talks about the barriers to American products around the globe, not just China, not just Japan, not just Malaysia, Western Europe as well. And the result of this, in part, is we're now approaching $10 trillion in cumulative trade deficits since the mid-1970s. None of our trading partners have that. So unless we figure out a way to change that situation, we're going to be in trouble. The other thing is the multinational corporations early on figured out the advantages of this to them. Closed their plants here, set up their plants somewhere else, make products cheaply, bring them back in because there are no duties or minimal duties on those products. Tremendous incentive for them to relocate abroad. And who gets hurt? Certainly American workers in this country, but also a lot of domestic companies that did not have the wherewithal, the ability to really export their operations abroad. We can't tell you that. I mean, the book has got many of these examples of these companies that have been run out of business, decent American domestically based companies who could not compete on that playing field, and Congress was totally deaf to their pleas when they came to them and talked to them about how various unfair practices were running them out of business. So we've failed in that area consistently decade after decade after decade, and now the result of it is millions of jobs lost, imports overwhelm exports every year, and the future looks increasingly bleak for manufacturing down the road. There's been a little blip in manufacturing employment the last couple of years, but unless some of these other real policies change, that's not going to last.
The other downside of this, Mark, is that this trade deficit we've had now for 37 consecutive years. And if this was such a good system, you would think that maybe occasionally you might get a trade surplus in there. Doesn't happen. And again, as Jim had mentioned, this is both parties when it comes to trade.
Mm-hmm.
It was Clinton, you know, who presided over NAFTA. And I can remember at the time I was down working along the border, and there were all kinds of stories down there about pretty soon General Motors would be shipping Cadillacs into Mexico. Well, that never happened, and there was never any possibility of it happening. And it should have been entirely obvious to anyone who'd spent any time in that area, because the money was not going to be in the pockets of the ordinary Mexican. But they spin these stories on global trade. It's like, I don't know, it's like a fairy tale that everyone buys into. And you would think that after all these years, with the same results, all negative and all harmful, that we would understand that doesn't work. And the really bad thing about this is they've said it over and over, they being the elites in Washington, that a lot of people sadly believe it. But unless, you know, forget the budget deficit. Unless the trade deficit is resolved, we will never have jobs, because it's the trade that creates the jobs. The trade deficit loses the jobs. It's not the budget deficit. The budget deficit in that sense is meaningless.
Well, I mean, in your book, you talk about a couple of things we can just mention and just play with a little bit. I mean, you talk about in the 5 years before NAFTA, Mexican imports to America increased by 51%. After NAFTA, they jumped 91%.
Absolutely. And this goes to the heart of the way people have been misled in this country. Some people, you might say they've been lied to. They've at least, at the bare minimum, been misled. NAFTA was sold on the basis, just as Don mentioned, on the idea that this would dramatically increase trade with Mexico. And export jobs pay more than other jobs. So all of this was supposed to be good. That is a theme that you can see repeated over and over and over again. The 70s, the 80s, into the 90s with NAFTA. It's still repeated now. Every president for the last four decades talks about the wonder of export jobs, how they pay more. And that's how NAFTA was sold. And, in fact, there were estimates by supposedly world-class economists that were showing all the economic activity that would be generated by this. Totally, completely wrong. And that's been the story of almost every trade bill. It has been a net red ink generator at the end of the line. And yet, each time one is put up and proposed, the same arguments are put forth. And the reason is because the power structure in this country is scared to say that free trade is not working. But in fact, the way we practice it, it is not working. Because for most of them, the big companies, corporate executives, stockholders, and some the big stockholders who derive benefits from some of the overseas production, that all works to their benefit. But it's not working to the benefit of millions of working Americans and middle-class people.
So if it's true, as you write in the book, and just a little bit more on NAFTA, because I want to kind of ask a what if. You write about the number of jobs were lost, 1.5 million jobs, a net loss of 700,000 jobs because of NAFTA as of last year's studies. But what would have been a NAFTA that would have worked for Mexico and America? What would have been an agreement that would have worked?
I suppose one of the things that might have worked would have been to have, at the bare minimum, phased this in a much, much slower rate. That would be one thing. And you would have to insist on certain kinds of similar standards in both the environment and labor. I mean, those are supposedly written into the NAFTA bill, but believe me, they don't exist in the real world. I mean, I think this is the other big flaw in free trade. And you see this more with China now. People think the reason China is sending so much stuff to us is just because of the cheap labor. That's part of it. But another part of it is how Chinese governments at both the national level and the provincial level support industries. They provide them land. They provide them low-interest loans. In some cases, they even help round up the workforce to man these factories. In other words, the total opposite of what free enterprise is in this country. I mean, how is one to compete on that kind of basis in this country versus that kind of system? And I think the book does nothing else. It cries out for both NAFTA and every other free trade agreement. Let's just look at this for what it is. This is not free trade. The Chinese are managing their trade agenda, and brilliantly for the most part, just as the Japanese have managed their trade agenda brilliantly over the years, just as many other countries have as well. But yet we're out there singing this tune, and none of the rest of the world is following it or listening to them, because they've got their own agenda, they've got their own mission, and who can blame them? They're trying to take care of their own people, and that's what our book says. We should be taking care of our own people, but we're not.
And as I was reading that, it's the question pops in my mind, you know, whether it's a local governments where people will fight against development in their communities or overdevelopment communities are being exploited in their own communities, partially saying that, well, look, these developers come into cities like Philadelphia and Cleveland and Baltimore, wherever they may be, and they get away with these tax breaks and they don't give us anything. But in some ways, what you're talking about, it seems, if you use a Chinese model, which maybe is a little bit more like a fascist model than a democratic model.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
is that
though? Incentives.
Is though that government does make those infrastructure investments for businesses to grow?
Absolutely.
So how do we bridge that contradiction, or is it a contradiction?
Well, certainly. Well, let's just take infrastructure. That's one example where the national government or provincial governments could easily do all kinds of things there. And in fact, we make a big pitch in the end of the book that
yes,
that's one of the things we need to think about in this country, because our infrastructure is crumbling. But at the same time, if we bolster that, it would generate not only a lot of economic activity on its own merit, but would have a ripple effect. And we're not just talking about roads and highways and sewer lines and water pipes. We're talking about high-speed internet, a whole range of things can comprise infrastructure. Other governments do this because they collect the taxes and the revenues that makes that possible. But if you're totally in anti-tax mode, as a lot of the country has been in for some period of time, you can't even think about that. That's one thing. I mean, the other thing is, what the Chinese have done in particular is probably the most dramatic example of this. I mean, the American solar industry is basically back on its heels today because the Chinese decided about 10 years ago that they were going to have this industry, the manufacture of solar photovoltaic panels. Technology was invented in the United States.
Right.
Bell Labs. I mean, another one of our examples of our innovation, our entrepreneurship, and all of these kinds of things. And we, the U.S., owned that industry for many years, even though it was always small. But at a time when we probably should have been significantly increasing something to encourage that, we began to pull back. And secondly, you had the Chinese who just poured tons of money into that solely for the export market. And essentially, they took over the world. They dumped their panels on the U.S. market, drove half the producers or more out of business in this country because of government support of those industries over there. That's, again, one of the messages of the book. We need to rethink the way we're practicing trade because there's no way for a domestic company to compete against those kinds of odds. It's not just cheap labor. It's just the whole cost of producing that that we're not facing.
And as you kind of point out in this chapter you have on free trade, I mean, it's across the Democratic and Republican spectrum when you talk about the closing of the Rubbermaid workers who lost their jobs, the list of companies that lost because of NAFTA, but also when you write about Gerald Ford not saving the shoe industry when it came to Brazil, but neither did Jimmy Carter.
Right. And you're exactly right. And every American president, we don't care what the party is so locked in on spouting the free trade comments that even when the facts are presented to them powerfully that that domestic workers are really imperiled by these, the way we're practicing this, they refuse to act. I mean, the Ford one you're talking about is one of the most outrageous ones in the book because when the shoe industry came to him and shoe workers and said, look, we're being killed by these imports that are coming in unfairly, so on. Ford refused to impose any additional duties on imports and said, by the way, the American shoe industry is now stabilized after this first rush of imports. Everything's okay. Completely wrong. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs have been lost since the 1970s when he said it had been stabilized. Today, there's almost no American shoe industry left. So I think this is why people are so upset in this country. They've been told things that turn out to be so wrong, and they see it around them, in their neighborhoods, in the places they go to work, the officials, economists, what have you, have assured them that all of this was going to work out okay. There'll be some dislocation, but you'll find another job, and you'll move on to the next great thing. And it just hasn't happened for millions and millions of people. That's why so many people are angry and frustrated and have really kind of turned their back on Washington.
The shoe industry was one we really took a look at and what went wrong 20 years ago. Jim interviewed shoe workers in the middle of the country, and these are people whose plants were just beginning to close, and the people were being thrown out on the street in small-town America. The other thing that made this very difficult for people to see is it didn't happen in one place. You don't lose if you lost 200,000 jobs in one fell swoop in one place, you might have gotten a different reaction. But it was just in small-town America across the country, these factories were closed, and people were thrown out of work. And, well, it's just another plant closing. And there's an old saw about insanity, the definition of it, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. You would think at some point someone in academia would say, you know, we're not getting the outcome that we were supposed to get from free trade. Maybe it's not a good idea the way it's practiced here.
Mm-hmm.
When you go back to what went wrong, that they wrote 20 years ago, some of our critics at the time said, you just don't see what's happening in the economy. Let these dirty jobs go overseas. Let a lot of this manufacturing go elsewhere. The brawn jobs. We're going to have the brain power jobs. We're going to have the really sophisticated ones over here, the knowledge-based jobs. That's going to be the future of America. That's why this is also where the new book is just a totally different book, because we show in it the evolution of what's happening now and what will happen. And one of the scariest things we ran across, a report that got very little attention at the time, was one by the Bureau of Labor Statistics a couple of years back that said, among service jobs, they estimated that roughly 25% of those jobs were susceptible to offshore. 30 million jobs. I mean, these are not rivet pushers on an assembly line somewhere. These are jobs, aerospace engineers, people who make $90,000 a year. Anthropologists are also in this category, $50-some thousand a year. Architectural drafters, epidemiologists, graphic designers, on down the line, even market research analysts, on down the line, 160 of these occupations are susceptible to offshore. And what's scary to us is the Labor Department historically has sort of been behind the times in estimating what was going to happen in the job market in terms of how rapidly some of these things were going to change. But if even they're predicting that, I mean, how bad is this going to be in the next few years? And what jobs will people have to take the place of those that are going somewhere else?
We're talking to Don Bartlett and James Steele about their latest book, The Betrayal of the American Dream, and we'll come right back to continue this conversation. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. We're here with Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their book before, of course, America, What Went Wrong, was a huge bestseller in the early 90s, in 91. They have won 2 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 National Magazine Awards. They're now both contributing editors at Vanity Fair. And this book is called The Betrayal of the American Dream. I want to just conclude one of these we're talking about before we went to break. Because this really is something at the heart of the debate that most Americans are having with themselves over the notion of why jobs leave and what is left for America. If we allowed the shoe industry, the clothing industry, any of these industries we're talking about, the consumer-driven industries, to remain in America, then Americans couldn't afford the product because it would be too expensive because of our union labor and our cost of living. And to many, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that's a very convincing argument, even though people are in a malaise and depressed about it because of their jobs and money. That's what we think.
Well, the problem with that is that people had no trouble buying those shoes when those factories were shut down. People were buying the shoes. They had the money. It's one of those false arguments. It really doesn't cut it. The other aspect of this is the early thing was, well, just let these jobs go because we don't need them. We'll keep the brain jobs. There was an incredible arrogance in that says the rest of the world doesn't have our brains. Well, as it has become abundantly clear, the rest of the world does have our brains. And you can even begin there with China. And increasingly, the scientific jobs, the research work is now going overseas. The pharmaceutical industry eventually will be headquartered in China. Make no mistake about that. They already manufacture all the main chemicals for the drugs that people in this country use. it generally is not recognized. It's generally not known, but it happens quietly. And it happens systematically, and it's if this is not stopped, this is going to be the third world country, and the Chinas, Brazils, Indias are going to eat our lunch. Period.
You know, the point you make about the consumer prices is an excellent one, because it really goes in many ways to the very heart of this whole discussion. And what the point we try to make in the book is that what you need in your society is a certain amount of balance. If you believe the lowest possible price is the only force that should govern the way our economy works, well, then you're not going to like this book. And you're also not going to like the way this country looks in a few years either, and the way it's increasingly looking. Because if it's just the lowest possible price, that's going to drive everything to the very bottom of things. We talk about the need to have a kind of balance. Yes, you're still going to have some imports. Yes, you're going to have some exports. But we talk about the need to bring some of these industries more into balance. We don't think for one minute that you can bring manufacturing back to the extent that it once was in this country. That's not feasible. It's never going to happen. But we need to figure out a way to at least take care of the manufacturing that we have left, to find some ways to bolster it and to make sure that the industries that are here are not destroyed by unfair competition, which has been what's happened in the past. I mean, we have a big story in the book on Apple, and how,
right,
Apple,
yes,
invented the personal computer, and it was originally designed here, and they began producing it in plants in California and Colorado. That was the historic pattern of development in this country for decades before this. But then in less than a generation, boom, Steve Jobs pulls up stakes in this country in terms of the manufacturing, sends everything abroad, much of it to China. We make the point, nobody's saying he shouldn't go to China if that's what he wants to do, but you didn't have to shut down everything in this country too, which is what happened. The contrast between the kinds of lifestyles that workers in this country have versus the one that workers in China have who are making the Apple products now, it's just breathtaking. In this country, the folks who originally worked for Apple, when Apple were making solid products, they had tremendous pride. They were able to purchase homes, send their kids to school, all the things middle-class families feel is important, which I think most Americans feel are important. In China, 90% of the workers live in college-like dormitories, 12 and 15 to a room. Some of them get so depressed from time to time, they try to kill themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Apple contractor in China, its most significant move to try to eliminate the suicides was not a significant change in working conditions, but was to stretch nets around their dormitory-like buildings. So if some depressed worker jumped off the top of his dorm someday, he would land in a net, he or she would land in a net, not kill themselves. I mean, Americans are pretty decent people, and most people don't really know what's going on in these places. And I think we think when more and more people do, they might be just also a little bit more willing to pay a few cents more for something than they are now.
And as you were talking about China, but just as a quick aside, I mean, there was this huge riot by workers just this week in China.
Yes, exactly.
And this is the same subcontractor at the root of all the other Apple problems.
Foxconn.
By the way, Apple's not alone. Apple's not alone in this. I mean, other companies do a lot of this as well. They're the most visible one. But it gets down to what kinds of lifestyles are we sort of encouraging to save a few cents on a consumer product.
The other thing, Mark, I mean, I've heard this argument so much that we wouldn't be able to afford the products if we made them in this country. If that's the case, how is it we can afford to buy $200 Nike sneakers made in China?
Right, or $2,000, I mean, Apple computers.
Exactly. Just cut me a break here. That's a non-starter as an argument. It has no validity whatsoever. Pricing is what the corporate world does, and they can price it anywhere they want. If they want to maximize their profits, which is what this society has become all about, that's why we have so many problems, that's what they're going to do.
I mean, look at the jobs that are being created anymore. Every year, the Labor Department runs a list of what those jobs are. They're overwhelmingly low-paying jobs. I mean, that tells you what the future is going to be.
This recession is going to end. When it does, things will start to look good. But make no mistake about it, the underlying problem is not going away. The overall trajectory for middle-class America is straight down. The same thing is going to happen this time. You can almost see it, the seeds of it beginning. Well, everything's good now. We've recovered from the crash. Everything is great. It is not. The straight line is down. There will be little blips up, but overall, the next 20 years will not be very pretty at all.
If we continue the way we've been going.
Now, I want to move over to taxes here in a second, because that's a really important component of this book and also your conclusion. But so I want to get there. There's one last thing about this, about moving jobs and factories overseas. I think you described yourself at one point somewhere. I saw Don Bartlett as an old cold warrior. But you're seeing the some of the jobs going overseas are pretty frightening when you think about the airline industry in America, Boeing, and who's going to know our secrets in building these airplanes and other kinds of things like that. This is a serious issue people also are not wrestling with.
Absolutely. And they're not aware of this one with Boeing, and Boeing is sort of almost the poster child. And what we're talking about here is our one significant export in this country, where we have a surplus of civilian aircraft. That's Boeing. Well, Boeing is, in order to get more business from China, has been locating or making joint arrangements with Chinese companies. Most of them, by the way, backed by their own government. Again, not exactly free enterprise. But one of the bargains that Boeing has had to agree to with the Chinese is that they're basically handing over to them the technology to build commercial aircraft. And the Chinese have founded a company. It's backed by the government. They even have a prototype out there that flies that's very similar to the 737, which is Boeing's bread-and-butter plane. I mean, for all of the stuff about the Dreamliner and the big planes, that workhorse is still that 737. That's where Boeing makes so much of its money. The Chinese have made no bones about this. They say, we are going into the civil aircraft manufacturing business. So here's Boeing and these joint ventures handing over the technology to a company that's going to be directly competing with them on a whole series of areas. So what will that do to our one last or our most significant export surplus? And what makes this especially galling is that Boeing is also a defense contractor, which has made a lot of money over the years on defense contracts funded by the American taxpayer. So some of the technology that goes into all of this, the civilian aircraft as well, certainly comes out of that whole intelligence bank that Boeing has been developing over the years. And other companies are told to do the same thing. You come to China, you want to do business, you're going to have to turn over some of your technology to us. And the Chinese have gone so much further than anybody before them. They don't just want the plants, the factories, the brawn jobs. They're insisting the companies also established research and development centers over there as well. John was saying in terms of pharmaceuticals, you've got a whole series of things moving over there that were supposed to be what would happen here as another country took over the brawn, the muscle jobs.
You know, in that Cold War era, say around the Cuban Missile Crisis time, if this had occurred, the defense establishment would have put the screws on it and said, "No, you're not going to open you're not going to turn over your aircraft construction blueprints to the Chinese. That's not going to happen." Or if it does happen, you are going to lose all your security clearances. And guess what? It would not have happened. But that's a totally separate track now, and nobody sees the connection between the two. And this is another one. Sometime down the road, there's going to be a huge price paid for this.
So let me I really want to get to the issue of taxes, because this is ought to be part of the heart of this book as well, and of what happened to America. And I think we also don't get it. This morning, President Clinton was on MSNBC touting what he did in the 90s and calling for greater corporate tax cuts. And so that I mean, that this gets to the heart of what happened to our money in America, besides having our jobs exported overseas. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, one of the things, Mark, for a lot of domestic corporations, and we make this point in the book, in a way the president's right. For a lot of domestic corporations, the taxes can be high. But for the multinational corporations, many of which have piles of money sitting in banks in Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Cayman Islands, you name it, the effective tax rate is not really very high at all. And that in part goes to just the heart of what one of the problems in dealing with issue is in the country. Depending on who you are, in corporate America, your taxes may indeed be a little high, but for an awful lot of the others, the taxes are not high at all. And in fact, you see these two being played off against each other. I mean, the multinationals that have all of this money sitting in these banks offshore, they keep saying to Congress and whatever administration will be in power, look, we will bring some of this back if you just give us maybe a 5% tax rate, unlike the statutory one, which is 35%. And as a result of that, we will create jobs in this country. Well, Congress fell for this line back in 2003, I think, or 2003 or 2004. And the 20 companies, I mean, I'm sorry, the 15 companies that brought back the most money, which they were taxed very lightly on, actually eliminated 20,000 jobs in this country. So, in fact, they were supposed to be creating jobs when they brought that back. So it depends on who you are when you start talking about the corporate tax thing. And that distinction rarely gets made by politicians.
And there's today they're sitting on, what, $1 to $2 trillion in overseas accounts. And then, of course, then the individuals are sitting on more trillions. So there really is no deficit crisis in this country that can't be solved by using the tax law that had been in place for decades.
Let's explore that a minute, because that is one of the huge arguments we have. We hear people argue all the time in America, again, mostly Republican, but also some Democrats, that you cannot tax wealth and solve the deficit problem. You're arguing in this book, in the great tax heist chapter, exactly the opposite, that you
can,
right?
Well, whether you cure the deficit or not, the point is you certainly lessen the issue of the deficit. I mean, the tax cuts over the last decade added a minimum of $700 billion to the deficit. As the famed Illinois senator used to say, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking about a lot of money. And it's something that exacerbated the deficit tremendously. And then toward the end of the decade, when the economy began to go downhill and there were fewer tax collections, that further added to the deficit. So the deficit has gotten worse, but it's gotten worse because less money is going into it from those two principal streams. And we make the point in the book, if we get the country going again in some decent way, tax revenues will increase. That will ease some of the deficit problems. Plus, people will be working more, and that will add to general economic activity and well-being throughout the country. I mean, that's one of the things we call for at the end. But the idea that the argument that this will not solve the deficit is a very convenient thing the economic elite had put out there to create the illusion that it's not important for them to be taxed. And all we're saying is, let's just go back a little bit the way we used to be in this country. Not all the way to the 50s, but just increase the rate on folks at the top. The more you make, the more you pay. That's the way it used to be long ago, and it worked beautifully toward keeping a very balanced and orderly society. You know, one of the big figures in the book, personal income in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, between the middle class and the very wealthy, grew at basically the same rate. But by the late 70s on, that began to diverge. And that's why, in part, we have this tremendous income inequality. And it coincides precisely with the taxes for folks at the very top being significantly lowered. So it certainly added to their wealth, And it's also, in more recent years, definitely added to the deficit.
So let's talk a bit about some specifics. Let's talk a bit about George W. Bush's Jobs and Growth Tax Reconciliation Act of 2003, what it did to dividends, and talk a bit about this thing that nobody knows about that you wrote about really eloquently, carried interest, and what those things mean in terms of what we're missing in America in terms of taxes from wealth.
Well, the 2003 Act was something that never happened before in this country in terms of what happened to dividend taxation of dividends. Always before, dividends, and by dividends, we mean taxable dividends, the money you get from a corporation, their stock holdings. If in the past that was taxed at the same rate as whatever your salary or your wages were, could have been 15%, could have been 25%, could have been higher than that. In fact, back in the late 70s, taxation of dividends was much higher than salary and wage income. So for part of our history, that has always been taxed at an even higher rate. Well, in 2003, they slipped in the fact that dividends, the maximum rate on them, would be 15%. This was a gigantic windfall to the very richest people in this country. Because while you'll hear a lot of them say, look, everybody owns stock now, 50% of Americans own stock, most of that is in retirement accounts, and most of it is held by people who don't have much stock to begin with. You look at IRS statistics of income, dividends go overwhelmingly to the top 2 to 3%, really the top 1% of the country. So they got a tremendous tax cut. It's been estimated to be at least worth $100 billion out of that one thing alone. The carried interest one is the shenanigans that the private equity boys enjoy on Wall Street, and that is they figured out a very clever way to have part of their salary declared capital gain income, which is taxed at a lower rate. And the deals they do, they end up taking a piece of the company. So unlike a normal investor who has to put up money for that piece, they don't do that. They're just given that as part of the deal. But then when they sell that, it's taxed at 15%, when in fact, it's just another part of their salary that's taxed at a lower rate. It's one of the reasons Mitt Romney's tax rate is so low, because a lot of his income has come from the carryover of a lot of those private equity deals that carried interest was involved in.
So let's talk in the time we have left about the, maybe we have to go back to a little history again, but how we can ameliorate that, how we can change that. What has to happen instead? Do we go back to the 71% of Jack Kennedy's era? I mean, do we go back to taxing dividends and these carried interests in a larger way? How do we really tax wealth? How does that play into it? What do we do now?
Well, it's a good question. You're either going to have to do that or institute a wealth tax. Actually, you're going to have to do a bunch of things. Another thing is a transaction tax on Wall Street, so that all of these derivatives and all this, it's really phony trading. It does nothing to add to the wealth of ordinary people. And that doesn't mean you stop it, but you don't encourage it by not taxing it. It's got to be taxed, and the rates need to be raised. I'll give you an example on the rates. And this really drives this point home. President Reagan, his tax rate that year was 31%. Mitt Romney's is 14%. This makes no sense. And Reagan is the person who's held out by conservatives as being the greatest thing since sliced bread by what he did. Well, all of a sudden, I think Reagan would be appalled if he came back and saw what had happened and is being done under his name, because he paid at twice the rate that Mitt Romney pays out. And what is really disturbing about Romney is he was asked in the last day or two, do you think that should be changed? He said, well, no, the private equity people should get this as an incentive. Where is it written that private equity people should have a tax incentive to make money? You know, you look through, conservatives especially always love to point to the Constitution to justify all of their actions. I don't, you know, we've gone through the Constitution a couple of times. I can't see anything in there that says people who make lots of money should pay lower taxes at a lower rate than ordinary working people or even poor people. It is so out of whack that it's going to require someone with an incredible backbone to say, this is it.
We make the point in the book that what we need to do, but it would require somebody with backbone, just as Don's saying, and that is we need to institute the kind of personal tax code where there are multiple rates, truly multiple rates, so that somebody making $350,000 a year, the last bit of their income isn't taxed at the same rate as somebody making $10 million or $20 million a year. I mean, that's what needs to be changed. And that's the way the tax code used to operate. And the country as a whole actually functioned better at that time. And it certainly would do a great deal toward reducing some of the income inequality that you see out there. But most of the whole thrust in recent years has been to reduce the number of rates on the total misconception that that supposedly is going to simplify the tax code. The rates have nothing to do with the complexity of the tax code. They have everything to do with the equity in the tax code. Because no matter whether you got one rate, two rates, three rates, you still got to compute your taxes. And but that has become a wonderful Trojan horse for years to try to drive down the overall effective rate for the very wealthy. And it's been tremendously successful. And it's at the heart of Paul Ryan's program that he announced earlier this year before he was vice presidential candidate. Rates are seen as this evil bit of complexity, when in fact they have nothing to do with complexity.
Now, I'd like to conclude just with the four questions, even though it's not Passover, I'm sorry. That was a bad joke. that you have in your book about what questions presidential candidates and other candidates need to be asked. And I'd just like to share them with our listeners, then we can conclude. Is that, will you support tax reform that restores fairness to personal and corporate tax rates? Will you support U.S. manufacturing and other sectors of the economy by working for a more balanced trade policy? Will you support government investment in essential infrastructure that helps business and creates jobs? Will you help keep the benefits of U.S. innovation within the United States and work to prevent these benefits from being outsourced? Nobody asks those questions, but those are critical questions.
Well, we think so, and I think it's one of the things that bothers us about the race all around. People are talking generally about jobs, but we are quite worried about the whole direction of jobs. It's not just the number of jobs, because most of the people we have in the book, in fact, are employed. They're not unemployed. But they're people who were making more a few years ago than they're making now because of what's happened in the economy. And who suddenly, even though some of them are got multiple college degrees, don't see a very bright economic future ahead. And that's what we need to be dealing with in this country. And that's one of the reasons why we talk about reforming the tax code, being a little tougher on trade, doing things to bolster manufacturing. And we make a very, very strong pitch, since corporations, for the most part, are not investing in the country. This is something the government can do. You'll hear this comment from time to time, government doesn't create jobs, companies create jobs. Terribly misleading. I mean, if the government spends money, that's going to create some jobs. The job will be then hired and generated by private industry. But there's all kinds of ways to inject money into this economy to get things, to put things on a more even keel. But beyond just this immediate thing, there's no long-range thinking that we're aware of about what's happening to these good jobs that are now starting to go abroad. What should be done about that? How should we address that? How should we think about that? And every person we've talked to who it's happened to, they sort of blame themselves. It's like something that happened to them, some failing on their part, even though in many cases they've got more than one college degree. They've done all the right things. And yet they're getting their head handed to them economically because of the way the system is working now. we'd at least like to see people talk more about that. And if the book does nothing else, we hope it elevates that discussion.
Well, Jim Steele and Don Bartlett, James B. Steele and Donald L. Bartlett, have written the book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. Just beginning our discussion here, we'll continue these discussions in coming weeks. Jim and Don, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com.